From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist George Will says, quote, "It is conservatism, not progressivism, that takes society seriously." For 45 years at The Washington Post, Will has both explored and declaimed on American life and politics. Through the apotheosis of conservative thought and political power in the form of President Ronald Reagan, to the consolidation of congressional Republican power in later decades. Well, now he sees America as entirely unmoored from the sensibility of its founders. Federal restraint has been replaced by a lumbering administrative state, Will says, an overpowering executive that's breaking the bounds intended for it by the Constitution. But in his new book, George Will, famously a foil of President Donald Trump's, never mentions Trump himself. So this hour on Point, George Will's conservative sensibility. And you can join us. What does conservatism mean to you? Do you see evidence that George Will's brand of American conservatism, grounded by natural rights, limited government, religious freedom, is that alive and well in the United States or on the verge of extinction? Well, George Will joins us today from New York. His new book is The Conservative Sensibility, and you can find an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org. George Will, welcome to the program.
I'm glad to be with you.
So first of all, I wonder if you just might offer us, what is your definition of American conservatism in 2019?
Well, the most frequently asked question, and it's a sensible one, of conservatives is, what do you want to conserve? And the answer is the American founding. In this case, it is the architectural structure given us by James Madison and others, separation of powers and all that. It is a doctrine of natural rights, the crucial premise of which is that first come rights, then come government. The premise dictates that one of the most important words in the Declaration of Independence is secure. All men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, and governments are instituted to secure those rights, which is a somewhat limiting aspiration for government, but for some of us, it's quite enough.
And regarding natural rights, though, specifically, meaning what in today's context?
In today's context, this is not grounded in any theological understanding of the origin of our rights. One of the chapters in my book that I think will cause some people discomfort and others comfort is called Conservatism Without Theism. It seems to me there's no logical or prudential necessity to involve theism in the definition of conservatism. By natural rights, I mean those rights that are conducive, as learned by experience, to the flourishing of individuals of the nature of human beings. It's, I suppose, broadly construed as rule utilitarianism, that we have as a rule learned through history that these rights are very important to human flourishing.
And so are you saying then that you no longer see the government as of the United States as protecting those natural rights?
I see the government as, in many cases, vigorously protecting those rights. It's to be applauded. But it has gone far beyond that and in the process has squandered its good standing. In 1964, I cast my first presidential vote for Barry Goldwater, to whose memory the book is dedicated. 1964, 70% of the American people said they thought the government did the right thing all the time or almost all the right time. Today, that number is under 20%. As the government's pretensions have grown, its prestige has plummeted. And one of the ironies of history, the government grew at enormous pace in the last 50 years, partly because Barry Goldwater lost so badly. He lost 44 states. Lyndon Johnson swept into office in Congress. The first liberal legislating majority since Roosevelt lost that in the 1938 election because of his plan to pack the Supreme Court. Government expanded pell-mell and promiscuously, in my judgment, undertaking tasks for which it was ill-suited. And in respect, we've had since then a vigorous debate about government's proper scope and actual competence. A debate that goes on today and a debate to which I hope my book's a helpful contribution.
So this pell-mell expansion of government, as you've been talking about, has occurred, you know, at least since the time of Ronald Reagan, under not just both Republican and Democratic presidents, but occurred even more dramatically under Republican presidents in the United States.
Quite right. Quite right. What this demonstrates, I think, is that one of the canonical texts of conservatism as it began its post-war intellectual revival was by Richard Weaver, a professor at the University of Chicago, who wrote a book called Ideas Have Consequences. I think we should update that and say the absence of ideas almost certainly has almost as large consequences. We're seeing this today in the nature of our politics. But Republicans, when they had their moment come round at last in the 1980s, began to lose sense of the fact that that conservatism teaches realism about making accommodations, accepting trade-offs, and making unpopular decisions. It's often said that Goldwater lost in 64. I used to say, actually, he won. It just took 16 years to count the votes. But something happened in the 1980s that is worth noting in light of today's interesting experience we're having with an emancipated, unleashed president. Until Ronald Reagan, conservatives had looked back upon American history and said, a lot of our problems developed from the fact that we have an overbearing, elephantine president that has been emancipated from constitutional restraint. Began with Teddy Roosevelt and his stewardship idea of the presidency, which basically was a president is free to do whatever he wills as long as he's not explicitly forbidden to do so. Next came Woodrow Wilson with his idea that the president is the great interpreter of public opinion and that Congress is an ancillary and inferior institution. Followed by Franklin Roosevelt, followed by Lyndon Johnson, conservatives for many years believed in congressional supremacy. Their text was James Burnham, an editor of National Review, and his wonderful book, Congress and the American Tradition. This healthy skepticism of executive power dissipated rapidly beginning in 1981 when conservatives had the heady experience of Ronald Reagan. It seems to me what we all should do, progressives and conservatives alike, is to rethink the consequence of the progressives' criticism of the separation of power, the consequence being the modern presidency.
Hmm. Well, so George Will, though, if I may ask, I'll put a slightly finer point on this because your book is a deep exploration of the philosophy of American conservatism and the roots from which it draws. But I mean, I hear you also agreeing that part of the problem is how deeply the notion of conservatism has been wedded to one particular party. I'm looking at beginning with Ronald Reagan, and you're saying that the GOP has not been authentically conservative as you'd like it for perhaps 40 years, and now we're at the point where the GOP we have a president who calls himself a conservative. You would reject that, but he has the GOP in his thrall. I mean, so my point is that wouldn't an honest assessment say that the political shell game that conservatives within the Republican Party have been playing is not a recent phenomenon, and we have inevitably arrived where we are.
The warfare on the Republican Party began in 1912 when Teddy Roosevelt said, I'd rather like the presidency back, and went to war against his protege, the incumbent president, William Howard Taft. This policy war, if you will, was replicated in Taft against Dewey, against Goldwater, against the Rockefeller Republicans. It's been going on. It's over now because the Republican Party since 1912 has never been this homogeneous. At the 500-day mark in Ronald Reagan's presidency, he had the support of 77% of Republicans. At the 500-day mark in the Trump presidency, he had the support of 87% of Republicans. So today the argument is over within the Republican Party, and conservatism is, as your question suggests, an orphan in a cold world at the moment. But there are worse things than to be emancipated from identification with one party.
Well, so I wonder, though, and I'm borrowing a line of thinking from Andrew Sullivan, who reviewed your book. I mean, he suggests that you do focus quite a bit on your critique of progressivism in the book, but he suggests that the greater enemy to American conservatism is the GOP. Would you agree?
Well, yes, in the sense that as long as it pretends to be the embodiment of conservatism. You know, Trump, to his credit, and I give him very little credit very often, he's almost rarely claims to be a conservative. You remember during the campaign, he said it's called the Republican Party, not the Conservative Party. He was making an important distinction. I accept that distinction. And today's Republicans are motivated primarily by careerism. They want to stay in office. They've seen what happened to Senators Flake and Corker and Congressman Sanford and others who've opposed the president. So in that sense, the party, stripped of its animating principles, has become a cult. It inevitably happens in politics. That's when the cult of personality emerges.
Well, to your point that he almost never calls himself a conservative, sometimes the president does indeed do that. In 2016, in a telephone interview on NBC's Today Show with Willie Geist, then-candidate Donald Trump talked about his, quote, conservative stances on issues.
I'm pro-life. I have, you know, a great record of being a conservative, but I'm also a common sense conservative, Willie, as we discussed before. I mean, you know, we have to do things with common sense, but certainly I'm the most conservative person there is on the border and on security, on the military, on taking care of our vets who are being taken care of horribly. I'm the most conservative person there is.
That's then-candidate Donald Trump in 2016. George Will, we'll get you to respond to that after we come back from a quick break. We are speaking with George Will this hour. His new book is The Conservative Sensibility. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with George Will. He writes a twice-weekly column for The Washington Post, something he's been doing for 45 years. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer as well. And his new book is The Conservative Sensibility. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And George Will, before the break, I had played that piece of tape from then-candidate Trump in 2016, you know, calling himself a common-sense conservative. So he does... He does ally himself with what he believes conservatism to be today.
Yes, and he conveniently defines conservatism as wherever his whim has taken him at the moment. He says, for example, he's conservative on abortion, he's right to life. He's been everywhere from right to life to in favor of third trimester abortions. I mean, this matters to him not at all. He says he's a conservative on the border. Progressives and conservatives agree that control of borders is an essential attribute of national sovereignty. That's when the argument begins, not when it ends. It's about the details. He says he's conservative because he's pro-vets. Find me a progressive who doesn't like veterans. I mean, it's a nonsensical definition. Could I swerve back for a moment to Andrew Sullivan's trenchant and very good review in the New York Times? Andrew makes the point, and Andrew's English, and he studied with the great political philosopher Michael Oakeshott in London School of Economics. And Andrew says, rightly, that something odd about conservatism in America, because whereas European conservatism was interested basically in established order and hierarchies and all the rest, American conservatism welcomes a constant churning. And I think that's exactly right. You know, Virginia Postrel, a wonderful American writer, said the Bible reduced to one sentence is God created man and woman and lost control of events. The conservative sensibility says, good, we like absence of control. We like the spontaneous order of society. We like the fecundity of freedom. We like the sense that no one has planned things, that we have outcomes churned up from below by an open society, careers open to talents, in Napoleon's famous phrase, and we welcome the fluidity of life in America. It is very much, when we say American conservatism, the adjective carries a lot of weight.
But he also says in that same review that the conservatism we're talking about stems in part, this is a quote from him, as all conservatism does, from a profound sense of loss. So how do you square this sort of almost nostalgic sensibility for, I don't use nostalgic in a prerogative sense, with the prerogative sense, but the sense of loss with the welcoming of the churn, as you were talking about.
Well, that's a good point. The loss that some conservatives mourn is the loss of a stable Jeffersonian, let's be frank, white America. That's not the conservatism I'm interested in. The loss I regret is the welcoming of openness, including openness to immigration, which I think has made America what it is and which we'd jolly well better welcome now that we have an aging workforce. So the nostalgia for which my kind of conservative feels is nostalgia for an embrace of the founder's principle.
Hmm.
The argument in America really is, our political philosophy can be understood as an argument between two Princetonians, James Madison of the class of 1771 and Woodrow Wilson, Tommy as he was known, Thomas Woodrow Wilson at Princeton, of the class of 1879. Woodrow Wilson was the first American president to criticize the American founding, which he did not do peripherally. He did it root and branch, taking direct aim at the constitutional architecture of James Madison and the separation of powers, which, Woodrow Wilson said, does not allow the government to be quick, nimble, acting with dispatch under the direction of a modern president. If you like the modern presidency as it is, good. You're a good progressive. If you don't, if you think rampant executive power is infantilizing for the country, this idea that America is run by presidents, that presidents set our moral tone, I mean, it's all nonsense. Give you one small example. In Woodrow Wilson's first fireside chat, he began with two words that don't appear in the transcript that is in the Roosevelt Library. He began with the words, "my friends." Now, imagine George Washington addressing a group of "my friends," or Andrew Jackson, or Grover Cleveland. I, for one, and I think someone with a conservative sensibility agrees, I don't want a president to be my friend. I want him to be my employee. He runs one of the three branches of one of our many governments. His job, as outlined succinctly in Article 2 of the Constitution, is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. That's enough.
Hmm. Well, okay, so there's a great deal that you just said, George Will. I'm trying to figure out which part to sort of pull the thread on here a little bit. So sure. How about this? When you say that you see Woodrow Wilson as the first president to criticize the American founding, one might see the Civil War as having been a giant cataclysm that was also a great, critical act of the founding of the nation.
Sure, it's our only constitutional crisis. We use the term constitutional crisis so promiscuously these days, it's being drained of all meaning. A constitutional crisis isn't when things are messy. That's democracy.
Hmm.
A constitutional crisis is when the constitutional institutions can't handle the forces let loose. We've had one of those, and it really began in April 1861 and concluded in April 65. Watergate wasn't a constitutional crisis. The constitutional institutions took care of it quite tightly, I thought.
Hmm. Well, the reason why I ask is because you speak of Woodrow Wilson and progressivism together, and you progressivism is a major part. Your analysis of progressivism is a major part of your book on conservative values, and I'm looking at a critique of your work that Damon Linkler wrote in 2014, and he said that you tend to use progressivism as an all-purpose boogeyman. And I just want to explore that with you a little bit, because
No. Actually, what's interesting is a lot of conservatives say, we'll quit calling them progressives, call them liberals, because it gives them too much credit to call them progressives. It makes them seem as though they're in favor of progress, and we're not. To which I reply, the pedigree of the ideas currently under the rubric of liberal traces right back to people who proudly called themselves conservatives or progressives, including Herbert Croly and his great book, The Promise of American Life, published in 1909 and still in print. How many books published in 1909 still are? No, I give full credit to the progressives. They were remarkably forthright in their rejection of the founders. That's what makes them admirable. And they had serious thinkers, Brandeis, Lippmann at that stage in his life, Woodrow Wilson, many others. And one of the great terminological train wrecks of American history is when we conservatives have now wound up as legatees of what's called classic liberalism. Understanding society is composed of rights-bearing individuals resistant to overbearing authority.
But maybe I misheard you, but weren't you pointing to Wilson and progressivism as one of the major drivers for the expansion of the, you know, the power of the executive?
Absolutely. Absolutely. From his criticism of the separation of powers flowed inevitably the emancipated president.
But I'm glad you said what you just said about your broader view of progressivism and conservatism, because as I read through your book, I actually came away with a certain sense of sorrow, George Will, to be perfectly honest, because you are calling for an authentic re-embrace of what are foundational American values. But I kept thinking that it's a great pity that these still must be viewed through any kind of partisan lens, as something owned by conservatism or rejected by progressivism, vice versa, however you might have it. I mean, are the partisan differences unavoidable today?
Well, there's nothing unhealthy about partisanship. My goodness, people have different views and different sensibilities, if you will, about politics. They cluster in groups. We call those groups parties. We've had a two-party system of the current framing of our partisanship since the 1850s when the Republicans replaced the Whigs. Nothing unhealthy about partisanship. And when Woodrow Wilson said, don't read the first two paragraphs of the Declaration of Independence, it will only mislead you, taking a direct aim at the what he dismissed as the 4th of July rhetoric of the natural rights rhetoric of Jefferson, he helped frame our current argument. And again, I'm not saying it's wicked. I'm just saying it's, in my judgment, mistaken. But it is this argument, this continuing argument, now a century old or more, that still, I think, animates our politics.
So nothing unhealthy about partisanship, but I would argue that many people believe there's something deeply unhealthy about the extreme partisanship we're experiencing now, because these very foundational values you're talking about are American. They should not be uniquely the province of one ism over the other.
Well, it depends on what you're counting as foundational values. It seems to me if you believe in the Madisonian understanding of the government as limited, delegated, and enumerated powers, and that the separation of powers should be power distributed to institutions that are inherently rivalrous and not when the president's party thinks of itself in Senate and the House as team players of the executive— that's one view, and progressives have generally viewed through their embrace of presidential supremacy an alternative view. Again, as I said, it's not wicked. I just think it's deleterious to national health. But this is what we argue about.
Well,
and, you know, if you don't like arguing, you pick the wrong country, because we are a contentious people.
And thankfully so. So, George Will, look, let's bring some of these contentious people into the conversation, if I may. So let's go to Matthew, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Matthew, you're on the air.
Hi. I guess I would just like to ask a question about, like, you're kind of using a lot of different, like, flowery language to, like, change the definition of conservatism. But what policies do you specifically not like about Trump? Because they seem pretty in line with what most people's definition of a conservative policy is.
I just think you're profoundly mistaken about what conservatism is. His two defining policies are protectionism and hostility to immigration. Protectionism is the obverse of conservatism. Protectionism is bossy government at its bossiest. It is government telling the American people what they can purchase, at what prices, and in what quantities. How much bigger and meddlesome can government get? Protectionism doesn't give rise to crony capitalism. It is born as and exists as crony capitalism. I can't think of anything less like the Hayekian understanding of Friedrich Hayek's idea of spontaneous order, of freely cooperating individuals in an open society, to use the great phrase of Karl Popper in his book Open Society and Its Enemies, than protectionism. Now, about immigration, the other two-legged stool on which this rickety presidency rests, hostility to immigration is hostility, A, to the free movement of people and inevitably the free movement of ideas. It is the idea that we should somehow freeze America as it is today or as it was in the 1950s. Again, it's part of the big flinch against freedom and, again, has nothing to do with conservatism.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Tim is calling from Altoona, Iowa. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I really just, especially at the point that you just brought up, Mr. Wells, regarding sort of the true nature of conservatism, I definitely admit that I'm a liberal, more right-leaning liberal, not a left-wing liberal, not an extreme case in one way or the other, but definitely more of a conservative liberal. And to me, from what I've researched and what I've seen online, and believe me, I've gone down plenty of rabbit holes on YouTube, but conservatism has not been your mode of conservatism for a long time. I mean, the conservatism that we see nowadays is sort of you have the GOP, the Republican Party, the Conservative Party, has been so much the let me foster every extreme group, mm-hmm. never fulfill those extreme promises, and now you look at what you get with Reagan at the very beginning in the 80s and ultimately culminating with Trump is they were pissed off about not getting what they wanted, what they were promised, and now the GOP is literally enslaved to them and saying, oh, crap, we've got to follow their leader. We're going to lose our voting bloc because we only have extreme groups anymore because, like you said, they're not pro-immigration because that's what made our country great again. They're not pro sort of letting regulations go out the wayside. I mean, I've always heard the regulation part, but that's right. A whole different story. But it's just at the end of the day, it's conservatism is not your archaic form. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just
right.
think it was,
well,
it,
well,
it
Tim,
was
Tim,
then,
let,
and it's got to evolve. So
let me get George Will to respond to that. Tim, thank you for your call.
Well, you see, what makes today the greatest publishing moment since Gutenberg, the arrival of my book, is that I'm trying to enunciate something that an idea that needs a home, doesn't have a political party at the moment, but there are worse things in life than going through life without a political party. I've done it now for 3 years since I left the Republican Party, and I find the experience bracing, frankly. I'm trying to say, here's an alternative. This is what conservatism once was and could be again. Let's argue.
Well, a listener calling themselves Gerald F. Nord says, I hope that Mr. will be pressed on the non-existence of a single conservative sensibility. Mike Pence isn't Peter Thiel, Russell Kirk wasn't Dwight Eisenhower, and George Will isn't Patrick Buchanan.
That's for sure. Pat is a old friend of mine. He's a Jacksonian, and well, suffice to say that. I mean, he's a good, pugnacious Jacksonian. I'm sure there will be people say, no, there are other conservative sensibilities. But I use the word sensibility to say, look, a sensibility is less, more than an attitude, but less than an agenda. It's a way of being comfortable with the flux of event a way of seeing the way the world changes and embracing change and fluidity and all that is driven by rights-bearing individuals. And I hope people will say, well, that's the conservative sensibility. I think I'll share it.
Well, we are speaking with George Will this hour. His new book is called The Conservative Sensibility. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with George Will. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post. He's been writing a twice-weekly column there for 45 years. His new book is The Conservative Sensibility. And George Will, I wanted to actually just play a little bit of tape for you. We've talked about President Reagan a couple of times here, but I would like to hear a moment from his inaugural address in 1981, first inaugural here, where he talks about his view of government. And here's what he said.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. From time to time, we've been tempted to believe that society has become too complex to be managed by self-rule, that government by an elite group is superior to government for, by, and of the people.
President Ronald Reagan in 1981 there. And George Will, the reason why I wanted to play that for you is we've got a comment here from Ray in Vermont who asks quite plainly, one might wonder if some of the distrust in government is rooted in the right-wing belief that it is the problem for the past 50 years. I'm wondering what you think about that.
First, I'm glad you played that, because usually when Reagan is quoted, they drop the first four words. In the present crisis. He didn't say that government's always the problem. His basic complaint was not with the New Deal, although mine is. His complaint was with the Great Society and much that came afterward. Look, conservatives understand, and this sounds like a paradox, but it's not, that laissez-faire, a free market society, is a government creation. That is, in my chapter on political economy, as the study of economics was once rightly understood, in the chapter on political economy, I talk about all the things government does to encourage human flourishing through free markets, which are government institutions. That is, it requires contracts and contract law and fraud protection and courts and adjudication and arbitration and all the rest. It's a complicated business that doesn't sprout like dandelions in the summer. It takes work. So conservatives want to keep government in its place, but we are not anarchists.
Well, so then adding to that, we have another comment coming in here from Raymond Breyer, who asks, does Mr. Will think that the anti-intellectualism manifesting itself in American conservatism by way of, for instance, things like climate denial, is so rampant, or has it always been this bad, or has it gotten worse lately? So that's a question from Raymond Breyer. But I mean, you have written quite extensively about your doubts on climate change. So are you anti-intellectual on that front?
I hope not. The Princeton, which gave me my PhD, would be quite alarmed if I were to turn out to be anti-intellectual. I dispute Mr. Breyer's contention that conservatism is in any way anti-intellectual. Many of the most interesting arguments to this day in American politics are not between progressives and conservatives, but among conservatives, because they take ideas so terribly seriously. This is a bookish persuasion. This famous story of Margaret Thatcher, shortly after she became leader of the Parliamentary Conservative Party, she was at a meeting of her caucus, and some guy got up and was nattering on about the beauties of centrism and all the rest, and she removed from her capacious handbag a copy of Hayek's Constitution of Liberty, slammed it down on the table and said, "This is what we believe." It's a bookish persuasion. Wait a minute. Wait. See, people say, well, Will's a climate change denier. Nonsense. The one thing we can all agree on and where discussion of climate policy has to begin is with the fact that, of course, the climate's changing. It always has been. Where I'm sitting today in Manhattan was probably covered by 10 feet of ice at some point in the history of our cooling cinder, the planet Earth. The question is not whether it's changing. It is the extent to which human activity is driving change today relative, say, to solar activity and all the rest. And it is the question of what are the appropriate remedial measures to deal with this and to accommodate the fact that the climate is always changing. So this is not an anti-intellectual position. It's an invitation to engagement with climate science as it actually is, complex and, contrary to what some climatologists say, a settled science, whatever that means. I remember a few years ago, the New Yorker had a piece that began on the, it was on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change had issued a report. And the writer said, "This report, which should be, but alas, will not be accepted as the final word on climate science." What in the... Try and formulate a sentence that says the final word on neuroscience.
So, George,
the final word on organic chemistry, please.
If I may, point taken about the bookishness of conservatism, but we're not talking about... in terms of climate science, and I want to explore this more with you because this anti-intellectual charge is worth exploring. So in terms of climate science, it's not political philosophy we're discussing. It's actual data. You've certainly seen this very famous graph put out by NASA that shows the parts per million of carbon in the world's atmosphere for many thousands of years. And the graph is relative, you know, it kind of goes up and down in a small way. But then post the Industrial Revolution,
it is
geometric in its growth. That's
exactly.
Data.
Now,
I mean, the reason why I point it out is because I hear you talking about climate change in the way you are. And I wonder if George Will were alive in the time of Darwin, would he say, well, you know, this idea that Charles Darwin is putting out about things evolving as the course of in the course of natural selection. Well, of course, things change all the time, but it's not his theory of evolution that's driving it.
That's an interesting thought experiment. Let me offer a counter one. Suppose Magna were alive during the medieval warming period. Extraordinary episode with enormous consequences for the development of society. Now, whatever happened in the medieval warming period, it was not caused by the internal combustion engine. It was not caused by industrialization. It afflicted a peasant society. It seems to me that the same is true with the Little Ice Age in the 19th century. There have been lots of changes, dramatic changes, convulsive changes in the climate over the millennia that cannot be explained by human activity, and so far as I know, have not been explained, period. You know, you talk about there are no doubt are Republicans who are impervious to scientific evidence, but it does seem to me I'm the son of a professor of philosophy who specialized in the philosophy of science, so I take it rather personally when I'm accused of being anti-science. Let me tell you a small story. When people start running for president, I usually go to see them and write columns about them. So 4 years ago, I went to see Bernie Sanders. "What do you want to do, Mr. Sanders?" He said, "Well, I'm very interested in early childhood education." I said, "Well, that's very interesting. Aren't we all? I've had four children. But we've now had 50 years of experience with early childhood education, Head Start and all that. And the data, the social science, is not encouraging. Often the results are of early childhood education are small and evanescent, often gone by third grade." His response to me was, "I'm sure there are other studies." Well, couple weeks later, I took to lunch. People forget now that Lincoln Chafee, former governor of Rhode Island, was running for president. And we had the same conversation at lunch. I said, what are you interested in? Early childhood education. We have 50 years experience, et cetera, et cetera. His answer was, I'm sure there are other studies. I sometimes wish my progressive friends would spend less time accusing other people of being anti-science and more time looking at the social sciences. As you will notice in my book, a recurring figure was a man who was my best friend, which was Pat Moynihan, a senator for many years from New York and unarguably, it seems to me, the greatest social scientist ever to serve in the legislative branch. And what I loved about Pat, and of course what he's remembered for mostly, is his famous statement, everyone, all people are entitled to their own opinions, but not their own facts. And I would just like to see more facts on the other side as well.
So do you accept the fact that following the Industrial Revolution, there's been a geometric growth in the amount of carbon in the Earth's atmosphere and that it is caused by human activity?
Sure.
Okay.
What I do not believe, we now know, if we're going to, again, be grounded in data, is the consequences of this, the importance of this relative to solar activity, lots and lots of other unanswered questions of what is an extremely complicated science, the science of climate.
Well, let us go back to our callers then. Let's go to Dennis, who's calling from Dothan, Alabama. Dennis, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question is this. You know, I hear a number of conservatives, they extol the virtues of conservatism. And there was a governor of Kansas by the name of Brownback, Sam Brownback. He was a conservative, might even call him a right-winger. He had a conservative legislature, both the House and the Senate. And we're told that the states are the laboratories of democracy. And he had an opportunity to put these theories into effect, and he did. And after eight years, it was a dismal failure, conservatism, so much so that the legislature said, this isn't working, we're going to have to try something new. So I would like to ask Mr. Will to explain, why was this a failure? I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dennis. George Will, go ahead.
Well, Dennis, I like you from quoting Brandeis, good Kentuckian, on the states as laboratories of democracy. I don't know the details of Kansas's fiscal condition. It seems clear that the tax cuts by the legislature, urged on by former senator, then Governor Brownback, were excessive. Conservatives believe in the lowest possible taxes, but the emphasis is on possible. The fact is the United States, in its collective wisdom, people have made enormous promises to themselves in the form of social services. To pay for these, we're going to need a certain level of taxation and a certain level of economic growth to throw off the revenues, which is why when people say economic growth is just too tumultuous, too frightening, dynamism is too many social frictions, we must erect walls and protect ourselves against globalization. My response is too late. Sorry, you've made promises that cannot be kept unless we have this economic growth. In short, when you made these promises to yourselves, the American people, you committed yourself willy-nilly, whether you know it or not, to an openness to economic growth and global forces that drive it.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. George Will, we've just got a couple of minutes left to go, and there's one last set of things I'd like to explore with you. Do you see the modern-day GOP as the party that you say it once should have been the natural home of the kind of conservatism you're talking about? But is it today, is it more the party of Thomas Hobbes, for example?
Yeah, don't libel Mr. Hobbes. Great man. From Hobbes came Locke, and from Locke came the United States. The problem is there are very few, but a few sterling people in the Republican Party, on one form of conservatism, that of Ben Sasse, who worries about the infantilization of America and the vanishing American adult, is very important, a senator from Nebraska. On the institutional derangements of the Congress shedding powers that it has no right to shed, let alone prudential means for shedding, you have Pat Toomey, a senator from Pennsylvania. There are good people there. And whether or not they are the seed corn of a future crop of proper conservatives remains to be seen. But there's still hope.
Is there still hope? Because I wonder if the future of the kind of conservatism you're talking about may be rather bleak, because people under the age of 40 simply have no living experience of this authentic George Will-esque conservatism that you're talking
about. Yes, yes. Yes, but now they're all going to Amazon's distribution system will groan under the weight of their orders as they try to get their hands on the conservative sensibility, and they'll see that there is another way. People have been writing off various movements for a long time, and they show more resilience than people might anticipate.
You do seem more optimistic than I think perhaps even many of our callers
That's an odd word because, as you know, part of my book is a summons to intelligent pessimism. There are so many ways things can go wrong. Now, pessimism is not fatalism. That's the point. It's intelligent. People should be intelligently pessimistic by being aware of all the ways things can go wrong. And Lord knows my book is a catalog of ways that, in my judgment, they have gone wrong. But as I say, it's not fatalism. So there are means and reasons for resisting.
Well, that's an interesting choice of words, George Will, because we
I
do have
it on purpose.
We do have listeners who do not want to let you off the hook here. As a last thought in the last minute we have, John says, George, you helped create this monster. It is too late to distance yourself from Trump. How would you respond?
Well, I think that's batty, frankly. I have no idea what I did to create Mr. Trump. I'm sure I was writing strenuously against him when the caller who said that was not. My pedigree as an opponent of the 45th president is really long and really good.
Well, George Will, he's the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post, author of many books. His latest is The Conservative Sensibility. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. George Will, thank you so very much for joining us this hour.
I enjoyed it very much.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Grace Tatter, with help from Alex Reese. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.